everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. We're going to take a journey today through history, not focusing exactly on food, but I'll tell you everything's related to food, and we can connect the dots as we go along. But I want to bring on Wendy Wollison, who is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University Camden and the author of a book called In Hoc, Pawning in America from Independence Through the Great Depression, which is published by the University of Chicago Press, and the co-editor of the collection Capitalism by Gaslight, Illuminating the Economy of 19th Century America. Today we are going to focus on a new book called Crap. I love the title, The History of Cheap Stuff in America. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you for having me on.
I really didn't know what this book was going to be about, but I have to say, it was a delightful and horrific read.
thank you, I guess.
So I know that historians just bring us the facts somewhat objectively. And I'm sure you have your own opinions, and I'm going to try and pull them out of you from time to time. I know that I had lots of reactions to all of the things that I read. So let's just begin. Did you come up with the word encrapification?
I did, yes.
Well, do you think it'll be in dictionaries soon?
I don't know. That'll be interesting to see, but it's interesting that you bring that up because a lot of people seem to respond and seem to have responded to that word. And they're like, yeah, that really sort of typifies the world that we're living in right now. So yeah, I coined that term. And if it fits our culture, then so be it.
Yes. Well, we know what it means right away, and you use it frequently throughout the book. So I'm just going to pull out things that popped out to me in the book. In the introduction, you write, most things were made by skilled and reputable hands working with good intentions. And we're talking about the 1700s. Mm-hmm. Supplying the needs of people within local communities, the consumer revolution, which began in the mid-1700s, changed all that. And then we get these crappy goods that appear artful, maybe, but they're very deceptive, poorly made, and typically don't last. It's difficult for me to process the motivations behind humans. And I know that it's strongly tied to capitalism. You've written about capitalism. To me, it's a very evil thing and brings out perhaps not the best in some of us. Can you talk a little bit about
Sure.
that?
Yeah, so I think it's important, you know, as a historian, I'm going to say this, but it's important to put these things into context, historical context. So we didn't just sort of wake up one day and start buying crappy goods, but there's a much longer history. And it, as you say, I make the point in the book that our relationship to our possessions has really changed profoundly over time. Particularly starting in the mid 18th century. But I want to say, and this is part of the crux of my book, actually, I think a really important part is that it's a history of consumer psychology. So there's this idea that just because these things appear on the market either today or 200 years ago, that people bought them or people buy the stuff that's offered to them. But, you know, we made choices and we continue to make choices about the things that we buy. So Americans in the past didn't have to buy these new crappy goods that were at first imported from Great Britain, but they did. And so, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in better understanding in the book is why. Why did people make those choices and change the relationship that they had to their personal possessions? Because we used to own very few objects and we cared for them and they became almost members of our family. They were passed down over generations. They served multiple purposes. The table that you would eat dinner on was the workshop table during the day, and maybe it folded out and then became a bed at night. And so these things mattered. And they withstood the test of time because they were made really well. They were handcrafted. And then, you know, as more goods flowed into the market, Americans shifted to really privileging and preferring novelty and change over a more conservative, what I call a more conservative relationship to their possessions. And why was that? So that's, you know, that's some of what I try to unpack in the
book. Do you think we were bored? Is it connected with a certain degree of boredom?
I think there was a certain degree of boredom. And then after time, advertising and persuasion convinces us that we should be bored, that we should be dissatisfied, and that we should seek out novelty. And that's even true today. Like often, you know, you will covet something like an expensive pair of Italian shoes. You want them and you want them and you want them. You become obsessed. And then maybe you get them. You wear them a few times. And then the object of your affection becomes something else. You know, so it's a different relationship to objects. I mean, I could go into like fast fashion and how our, you know, what we do with our clothes has changed. But in any case, I thought and think it that it's important to put this story into historical context. And I think it surprises people that Americans were buying crappy goods like well before the 20th century.
Yeah, I've been talking about a number of more academic books going back to the history when the industrial age started. And that's what I keep learning. It's like, this all started, all our problems started a long time ago. All our bad habits started a long time ago. All our toxic food problems started a long time ago. All our crap started a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear. So yeah, there are definitely downsides to this, and there were at the time, and we can talk about sort of the implications for today. But one of the things I also say in my book is that cheap goods, both in quality and price, allowed more people to participate in this world of goods that became more and more important. Americans became active consumers, and stuff not only brought negative things, but it brought positive things as well. Sometimes this novelty was good. These petty luxuries were things that brought pleasure to people's lives that they would not ordinarily have otherwise. It was a democratized form of consumption that also, you know, increased production. It provided more jobs. It sparked innovation. Some of these things, especially gadgets, are highly creative and highly inventive. So I want to just say that, yes, that there are a lot of negative aspects to this, but there are also a few sort of hidden positive aspects that we might not ordinarily consider.
Yeah. Well, so. I've heard some people say that the washing machine was probably the best invention of the modern age. Yeah, and not the earliest washing machines, but maybe
right.
Because you described some disasters.
They were disasters, yeah. They were but again, like it's a really great example. Or the answering machine. Like now we have voicemail, but the answering machine was first this like weird upscale gadget for very rich people and had very little utility. And now it's something, that function is something that we can't live without.
Absolutely can't live without. You talked about made in Japan and then later made in China.
Right.
And I remember growing up a long time ago, And I remember the negative connotation linked to made in Japan on all the things that were out there, toys and things. And then I was working as an engineer in the 80s in the semiconductor industry. And Japan was an active player, and not just in the semiconductor industry, but also the Toyota came about. That was my first car, and it was almost criminal that I bought a Japanese car, but I wanted the most reliable.
Yeah.
And so Japan's status was kind of elevating, and I would visit Japan. And what I was surprised about, maybe you could explain this, the things that I found in Japan in the stores were all high quality. They always package things with beautiful paper. Even the wrapping was the treat, not even just what was inside.
Right.
I bought these laminated placemats in the early 90s, and I still have them and treasure them today, and they're so well made.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening there? Crap and quality.
Right, and that's actually a really interesting story. So Japan opens up their markets to exports starting in the late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s. And what they start doing is supplying goods to five and dime stores. And they can do this because Japanese production is organized around small family manufactories. And if you unpack that word, think about the manu in factories, that means by hand. And so these people were kind of working like machines, but in these small family units. And they were making things that were very often very intricate, but had to be sold on the market very cheaply. And the example I give is the cocktail umbrella, you know, the little paper umbrella that appears in like Mai Tais and daiquiris and things like that. And if you take a look at that as an object, it's a really actually very complicated thing. It's made of paper and wood and cardboard, and all of these little pieces have to be glued together, and it can't be mechanized. So the Japanese were making, they already had this established pattern of production for their domestic markets, and so they just used that and amplified that for export markets to make these cheap goods that could be sold in five and dime stores.
In America, five and dime stores.
Right, in America. And that becomes the case all the way up until World War II. So they're selling things like, as you mentioned, paper goods, bamboo things, you know, like bird cages, wire work goods, and all these, you know, Christmas decorations, all of these things. And then, of course, the war starts, and there's great pressure on American retailers to reject Japanese goods. And made in Japan becomes this epithet. It becomes this, like, swear word, and Japanese goods become associated with cheapness, as they had in the past, but even more so. And, you know, became associated with sort of supporting the enemy mm-hmm. if you are selling or buying Japanese goods. After the war, in an attempt to help countries like Japan and Germany get back on their feet, the United States made a concerted effort to buy cheap imported goods from these countries. And they said, like, you know, like the road to rehabilitation is going to start with cocktail napkins, you know. And so Japan kept making some of these objects, but because their manufacturing facilities were completely decimated after the war, they literally rebuilt themselves and rebuilt their industry and embraced, as you said, high-scale electronic equipment, bicycles, cameras, you know, things like that, automobiles. And as they moved into those sectors, other countries, Hong Kong, China, moved into the cheap goods sectors. And we know how that story ends up to the current day, with China becoming like the global supplier of cheap goods.
Well, you're right. China's rapid industrialization in the late 20th century can be largely credited to or blamed on Americans' insatiable appetite for crap.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's a bold claim, but again, like, if there's no market for these things, there's no incentive for them to be produced. And so one of the things that I ask people to consider in my final chapter is what would the implications be if we stopped buying all these cheap things? Can we imagine a world without crap? Do we need all of this stuff? And, you know, can I often wonder if the people, say, in these Chinese factories, do they even understand what they're making? You know, I'm thinking of weird things like those, you know, those drink koozies, those beer koozies that have, like, boobs on them or something. Like, really bizarre things. There are a lot, but there's the point is there's, like, a lot of really weird, crappy stuff out there that doesn't need to exist at all. It, like, has no purpose. Sometimes it's really hard to explain, like, what the thing even is. And yet, there are all sorts of resources being put toward making this stuff, which has environmental implications, human rights implications, and so on.
I want to talk a little bit about food, because you talked about some food-related inventions. I'm a long-term vegan, 32 years, and vegetarian before that. And when I read about what we've done to automate the exploitation of animals for food and slaughter, I just don't know how humans go there, but we do so well. Yeah. And you mentioned a couple of things I wanted to bring up. Hooker's patent self-animated philanthropic frying pan, which automatically flips bacon, or so they say, when it's half done. And the other one, worse, Jonathan's patent life-saving self-adjusting hog regenerator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you explain that one? Which obviously it wasn't what it claimed it was.
Right. So those were examples of you know, satires or jokes about extreme gadgetization. And those both appeared in the early part of the 19th century to sort of make fun of this idea of Yankee ingenuity. So Yankee ingenuity was this sort of spirit of inventiveness that brought us things like the Reaper and the cotton gin, you know, like big important inventions and small ones like potato peelers and things like that. A lot of people embraced this spirit of invention and embraced these gadgets, these new, what they called newfangled objects. But a lot of people didn't. A lot of people rejected them and said, basically, this is, you know, these things are, you know, BS in material form. And so we should really turn away from these new inventions. And so the patented hog regenerator, which like, basically, and there's a really great, I have this great, it's one of my favorite illustrations in the book, is this machine, and the hog goes in one end, and out the other come like bristle brushes and links of sausage. And it even says like, and nothing's left but the skeleton, which then can be sold to medical, you know, medical schools for examination. So the point is that this gadget was overpromising all of this stuff to automate easily what, you know, what you talk about, which is this, actually really violent process of animal slaughter and what's called in the Industrial Revolution, you know, processing. So this is making fun of the absurdities of new gadgets and Yankee ingenuity, but at the same time, it's sort of celebrating the spirit of inventiveness.
Okay, a couple of products I liked. The shower chapeau. Which I think should make a comeback now for COVID-19.
Yeah, I love that. It's basically, it's a shower, it's a whole head shower cap with like this clear visor so that you can do your makeup while your husband, it's like this really gendered, like if your husband's in the shower, you can wait for him and take your shower second, but you can still do your makeup.
Yeah, I would bring it back. I think it's a great COVID mask because you can see your face.
It would be, yeah.
It's yeah, and it looks kind of comfortable. Okay, the other one was, you talked about the Vitamix and the commercials in the 1949. Is this the same Vitamix that we all love today?
Yeah.
That is an awesome gadget.
Yeah, it's an awesome gadget. And not only that, but Papa Bernard kind of invented the modern infomercial. So he promoted these things at first on TV, created this long, like 30-minute show, basically, where he demonstrated all of the different functions, the things you could do with this thing. You could make pancakes, you could make what we would call smoothies today. You could do all of this stuff. And he was an old carnival barker, so he had this this experience in the performing arts. And so he was really good at creating a kind of dynamism around this product. One of the things I point out in the book is that a lot of gadgets are attractive to us because of their sort of magical function. And that magical function can't really be, it's not necessarily inherent to the gadget. In other words, it has to be demonstrated to us and demonstrated in very flamboyant ways. And so Papa Bernard was really good at doing this because he had worked in carnivals. And so he kind of invented what became the modern infomercial.
You have a section called The Commodification of Quaintness. And I have to say that it was a little heartbreaking to read about it because I kind of buy into the beauty, the quality, going to a tea room and just seeing quality. I mean, that's what I'm enjoying, the quality of things. And maybe some of it isn't really quality, and what the copies that we kind of pick up are not as well made. But I buy into the romanticism of how things used to be better made, and I miss that.
Yeah, and what's interesting there is how now that quaintness is kind of manufactured. So like the distressed look is something that isn't a function of like well-worn time, but something that's actually produced brand new in the factory. And so, yeah, and so for those kinds of objects, that crappiness I identify as being kind of a dishonesty in that the surface is created and not kind of honestly come by.
Yeah.
Shabby chic is another, you know, kind of aesthetic, I don't know, movement or preference or style that kind of typifies this also.
And then you tie it into, I would like to think it's somewhat subliminal, a prior error for the privileged folk to think back to a simpler time and let's put quotes around simpler, a time where the privileged had more power and we didn't have to think about the concerns of the poor, the minorities, the people of color, women.
Right, right.
And yeah. That's a tough one.
So one of these stylistic sort of movements that I unpack is the colonial revival, which is still with us, but it gained traction at the end of the 19th century at a time when Americans were turning away from immigrants. There was waves of xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment. And, you know, I kind of asked the question, well, why are they filling their homes with all this colonial revival, you know, what I call crap? I mean, things that they don't need, like andirons and reproductions of like, candle-lit lighting fixtures and cast iron doorstops and all this weird stuff. And I...
Butter churners.
Right. And like spinning wheels in your living room. Like, why do you don't need copper kettles? And we still have that stuff. It's often like stuffed with dried flowers and things like that. But anyway, so, you know, I wondered, like, why was this particular era the one that so captivated people and was romanticized? And I make the argument that it was a way for basically privileged white people to celebrate their privileged whiteness by signaling this specific past, this colonial past, which was free from, as you suggest, free from complication, this idea of it was a simpler time, meaning that hierarchies were clearer, people's roles were clearer, and their positions were unquestioned. And of course, that's like the aesthetic of white supremacy. And what I found especially curious was that a lot of the merchandise catalogs that sold this colonial revival stuff, these reproductions of this earlier time, also sold racist, just outwardly racist memorabilia. Samba letter openers, Topsy sewing, school holders for sewing thread, like these really weird, oddball things, mammy laundry bags, like really weird, uncomfortable, distasteful, offensive things. And I thought, well, what is the kind of through line? What is the overarching logic? And what kinds of consumers is this geared toward? And going further, like what signal would they be sending to others if they displayed these things in their home? And so that's one of the things I tried to unpack.
A really difficult part for me was the last part, the jokes on you, where you talk about all of these crappy practical joke items that people could use. So mean.
Yeah.
And not funny on the victim, which was often a woman. Mm. And how that kind of strengthened and perpetrated this awful culture that we're trying so hard to get out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a difficult one.
That was something that surprised me as I did the research. A lot of this research, I have to say, was a lot of fun. Like trying to figure out the history of this exploding cigar, for example. Like, when was this exploding cigar invented? Things like that. So it's really enjoyable, but it was surprising to me the more I dug into these jokes and novelties. So we're talking about things like fart powder, exploding cigars, plastic vomit, you know, all of these things. And trying to tease out what their cultural meanings were and trying to answer the question, like, why did these things need to exist when they did? And as you point out, one of the things I discovered was that these jokes and gags were actually not funny. They were mean-spirited, perpetrating violence often, and that they were highly gendered, which to me reflected women's presumed roles. A lot of these jokes and gags, most of them were marketed toward boys and men. And the things, the toys and objects of entertainment for girls were things like dolls, sewing kits, kitchen appliances, the things that really trained them for their domestic roles as adults, whereas boys and men got these more expansive, more entertaining objects to play with and often could deploy those objects against girls and women.
Yeah. I'm just remembering what toys were available to me when I was young. And they were very gendered.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
My favorites, I really wanted building blocks of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine had a gas station and I loved his gas station, but it wasn't for me.
Right. It wasn't for you. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Just a couple more things.
Sure.
I loved the catalogs that we used to have. I remember the green stamps as a child, collecting them and then going through the catalog and imagining what we could have. There was that wonderful feeling of possibility.
Yeah. Right, right.
And then when I was older, I don't know how the Lillian Vernon catalog appeared. Did I ever buy something from Lillian Vernon? I hope not, but I probably did.
Maybe.
But so much in it was stuff that that was offensive to me, but still there were things that, oh, that's kind of curious. And yeah, just kind of the bizarrest things. Who needs these things?
Who needs these things? But, you know, you have a really good point when you talk about the possibilities of things. And that's one of the, you know, if I see a few glimmers of positive things about this story, one of them is this sense of possibility. And that the sense of possibility that we experience through material goods becomes accessible for more and more people as cheap goods come onto the market. Those possibilities were always there for rich people who could afford the entire universe of objects that were out there. They could afford to commission really nice pieces of things. And so they not only had the luxury of imagining these things, but possessing them. And with the increase in cheap goods, both in quality and price, that possibility then trickles down to more and more groups of people. And I think that's an important thing to consider, especially when you think that we live in a world of goods, and we live in a world where we express ourselves often through material objects. And so to deny a lot of people access to a great deal of those material objects means that they're literally not in that conversation, literally not able to express themselves as others do. So there is a kind of a leveling force here. I'm not saying that that's like a terrifically positive part of the story, but I think that this idea of possibility and imagining other worlds is really important.
When I used to travel a lot for work, I would enjoy thumbing through the SkyMall catalog, the Hamacher Schlemmer stuff, and of it was just totally out there. Who buys this stuff?
Yeah.
Crazy. I can't even remember some of it, but just totally out there inventions. But I have to think that because that catalog was always there, people were buying from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It must have been. Yeah.
Okay. So we just came out of the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Big gift giving holidays. It was a little different this year for many people because of COVID. And more people have limited incomes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what kind of stuff people were buying, but now we're on the other end of that, starting a new year.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about gift giving and stuff in general in your life?
Well, let's see. That's a kind of a personal question. How do I feel about gift giving? I try to give very thoughtful gifts. I try to give few gifts, and I try to encourage people who are considering giving to me, giving gifts of donations to, you know, things like food banks. I'm doing really well. I don't need anything more in my life. One of the things I mention in my book is that what do we get for the person who has everything? The answer is never nothing. You know, we always want to have to give them something more. You could give them a copy of my book, I suppose.
A great gift.
But what I also find is that people are very uncomfortable doing just that. They feel like we need to sort of consecrate our interpersonal relationships with a material object, for whatever reason. But kind of pulling out from my personal experience, what I'm actually really interested in seeing is how COVID might change our relationship to objects. I've heard that more people, because they're spending more time at home, are sorting out and cleaning out and taking a lot more stuff to thrift stores, and that thrift stores are now inundated because they can't handle all this surplus. On the other hand, I don't know if when people start getting, if there's going to be another stimulus check, or if they're going, if unemployed people find jobs, if they're going to start spending more, if there's going to be a pent up kind of consumer demand for things like we saw after the Great Depression. And I don't know. I don't know the answers to those questions, but they're very much on my radar. I'm pretty interested in seeing what's going to happen.
When I was first starting out as an adult with an income, the malls, especially the makeup counters, had these promotional gifts that you could get if you bought something. Mm-hmm. And I remember in those early days around gift giving time, I just had a party. I bought all these things and I had all these extra things. So I had so many things to give people that I thought was really fun. And sometime after that, I got into anti-consumerism and I kind of became a Scrooge where I didn't want to buy stuff and I didn't want to get stuff. Mm-hmm. And I believe I didn't want to be made to give on a certain occasion. I wanted to give when it was my idea. So those of you who know me, you know that that's what I'm all about. And the things that I like to give may be something that's usable. And it's not always apparent what's usable for everyone, but you could take someone to dinner and they're going to eat and that's usable for them. Or you could make something homemade that you know that they're going to like. Or buy them a book that you know that they're going to enjoy reading. But I want my gifts to have some usefulness rather than the adding to the encrapification of America. And that's tough. And the hardest part of all with anything that we buy is knowing who made it.
Right, right.
And all the people that were involved in bringing a product to you, and very often they're exploited and underpaid.
Right.
And fortunately, there are more groups that are exposing all of that information, and we have more regulations to try and prevent that, but we have a lot more work to do.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And the implications of that, if we turn away from these cheap goods and if we become more thoughtful about the things that we buy, that has implications and ramifications that we can't even imagine. One of the challenges to that, of course, is that you have to be fairly privileged to be able to buy things of quality anymore. And one of the things I point out in my book is there's this kind of cycle of degradation, that we have exploited labor overseas making these cheap goods that are retailed over here in big box stores, which pay their workers barely a living wage, and so that they can only afford to buy those very cheap goods that they are in the service of selling. So, you know, it's one thing to say we should be more ethical consumers, but it's another to say to somebody who works for minimum wage at Walmart, less than minimum wage sometimes, like, oh, you should buy this artisanal pair of denim jeans for $300. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't do that.
Yeah, we've got ourselves in a nice spot. Well, I say the best gift anyone could get right now is a copy of Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. I really enjoyed it. And for those of you out there who don't realize what consumers we are, I think this would be a good wake-up call. I'm on this thing where I think we should think of ourselves more as citizens on this planet rather than consumers.
I agree.
And do whatever you can to make that happen. Wendy A. Wollison, thank you for joining me. Thank you for writing this book, which I enjoyed reading. Thank you for your research and your work.
Thank you for so thoughtfully reading the book and asking such great questions.
I read books, and yeah. I don't like talking to people about their book unless I read it.
I can tell you did your homework, and I do hope you enjoyed it. Or, you know, maybe enjoy isn't the right word, but...
Well, yeah, I read a lot of...
You said you were distressed by it.
Yeah, I read a lot of books about food. And there's so much distressing information about food and our health and the environment and the planet. But at the same time, I enjoy a well-written book that really tells the story. And what I want to say about this one is I have been reading a lot more academic books about history. And your book is very readable. some of them are not. Far more difficult to read because every other line is a reference.
Right.
But thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
You're welcome. Right. Take care.
Take care, Karen. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Wendy A. Wollison, the author of Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. I have to say, that's a fun title. Crap. It's fun to say. And we all learned a new word today. Encrapification. Can you spell encrapification or use it in a sentence? I'm going to call on one eager student. Gary DiMattei, can you use encrapification in a sentence?
I cannot, but I am really in love with this book. And that interview that you just gave was fantastic.
Okay, encrapification, which is not officially entered into any official dictionary that I know of, but it should. Encrapification, encrapification. That's a noun, the encrapification. You could also use it as a verb to encrapify.
Oh.
Our country has been encrapified.
Conjugating that encrapification,
yes,
verb,
I'm
Karen.
I'm using past tense.
Our country has been encrapified.
Yes, and we have been encrapificating. Anyway, you can use this word in many different forms in the English language, but the point is, we have a love affair with crap.
Yes, we do.
We've been manipulated to have a love affair, but we've also kind of fallen into it with our own free will.
I agree about the manipulation part, which is why I think if you major in marketing, you are going to bed with the devil. I don't like marketing because it brings us places that we don't need to go.
There's got to be some marketing out there that's beneficial.
I think the marketing we do, the marketing that Responsible Eating and Living does, the nonprofit that just won an award of excellence from the Progressive Radio Network, presented to Karen Hartglass. It's all about food, outstanding programming, healthy living.
Thank you, Gary. Yes, I was very surprised.
Progressive Radio Network's founder, Gary Null, and program director, Jesse Funk, started the Progressive Radio Voices Award group for their hosts this year. Real co-founder, Karen Hartglass, and the It's All About Food podcast was just given the Outstanding Programming Healthy Living Award of Excellence. Thank you, Progressive Radio Network. Thank you, Karen Hartglass.
Thank you, Progressive Radio Network. I do this program because...
You like making vegans.
Well, just like I'm on this earth to make vegans, I am doing what I think I'm on this earth to do and be of service. And
that ain't a bunch of crap. That's the truth. You are not encrapifying this conversation.
Thank you. But it is very nice to be acknowledged.
Yes. And how many years have you been doing this program? Only 12 years.
In March, it'll be 12.
Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations, Karen.
Thank you.
Now, back to crap. So, what did you like about Wendy's book? I liked everything about it.
I liked things that brought me down memory lane. Now, this book covered history from the mid-18th century to the present. The stuff from the mid-1900s.
Yes.
To today.
Present day, right.
Were especially meaningful to me.
What's some crap that you maybe read about in the book and you thought, wow, I really liked that crap when I saw it, but now I'm really glad I didn't go out and collect it. Was there anything that was happening when you were a kid that you thought you would like to? I mean, what comes
Come
to
on,
mind?
Come on, everything. Well, one of the things that I was talking to Wendy about was the free gifts that were given in a department store.
Right.
I was enraptured with the ones that came with...
You were encrapified.
With makeup items.
Oh, right. The free makeup gifts. Yeah.
And at the time, I was really into Lancôme.
Sure.
And some other high-end brands. I'm not anymore, folks. They're not vegan. Okay?
No, I can remember, too. Even the men's department would give you free gifts if you
bought something, a free tote bag.
Well, it hasn't stopped, but I really bought into it when I was in my early 20s. And I didn't talk about this before, but my dad, I want to say that he played the marketing game.
Right.
He didn't get trapped, or maybe he didn't get encrapified, but...
He didn't get crap.
But it, well, yes, in some ways he did. So let me explain. He bought into the sign up for whatever it is, a subscription, a product, and you get something free. And then he typically would get the free product and then cancel and right. not get whatever it was for sale.
Yes.
And he did this with encyclopedias
right.
when I was young. And we had the A volume of a number of different collections because you would get the A volume.
Oh, that's hysterical.
For free. And then you were supposed to buy into the rest of the collection.
He didn't do that.
He didn't.
He just wanted the A volume.
He just wanted what he could get for
free. He just wanted the freebie. I get it. Okay. Well, hey, so you had a bunch of A volumes of everything lying around.
Yeah.
The start of a bunch of sets.
But still, it was crap.
Yeah. I remember SNH green stamps. I know you touched on that.
Yes.
Blue chip stamps. I know you maybe didn't have blue chip stamps out here, but we had them out in California. And you go to the grocery store and you get these stamps and you stick them in books and you redeem your books for crap. Right? You had to walk through the doors of one of these crap outlets and they would give you a blender, a toaster for 25 books of
right.
blue chip stamps. Or so we would all sit around the table. This was the fun part. And there would be this huge bag of stamps, which you'd get from the grocery store. And we'd all have this stick them in the book party. And you know, it was just, they were just making you jump through hoops to get things that were absolutely worthless. We'd bring the knife home or we'd bring the cheese grater home or whatever it was. And it would break. And you couldn't go back and redeem it for another one. It was a final...
Well, that's the sad part of the story, that if we're going to get things, these things should be made well. They should be quality. But
sure.
Nothing is made well anymore.
Not even the things you buy.
Yes. Things that you buy. Even some of the things you buy that are expensive.
Yeah, like phones.
Are not made well, like phones.
Like phones.
Let's talk about the telephone here for a minute. Okay, this isn't about food, but it's kind of related because it's all about...
responsible eating and living.
Living and products and whatnot. So who remembers the early phones from Bell Telephone?
Yeah, of course.
They were heavy as bowling balls.
They were made of bowling ball rubber. They pride themselves, or they took pride in the fact that they could withstand punishment. You could throw the phone off of a top floor of a building and it would still work. You could freeze it in the freezer. You could heat it to temperatures that would normally melt other pieces of plastic. And these things were indestructible. They were indestructible.
They were indestructible. And then we went to...
The company took pride in the fact that they gave you an indestructible phone. And how many people slam their phones, or used to at any rate?
And where is Bell Telephone today?
Who knows? Non-existent. Where are the operators of today? Can you dial zero?
Yeah.
No. Try it. You'll not get a live voice. Can you dial 411? Can you dial popcorn? Can you dial...
Remember what does popcorn get you?
The time.
Popcorn.
Yes.
Oh, see, now we're back to food.
Exactly. If you dialed popcorn, P-O-P-C-O-R-N, which was seven numbers, but you would look at the letters.
You would get the time at the tone.
At the tone, the time is.
Yes, but when now we have these overpriced, very expensive,
not indestructible.
Not indestructible, and also destructing the planet while they're being made.
Yes. Oh, we sound like we're a bunch of old fogies, don't we?
Anyway, that was a nice book. Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. And if you know someone who likes stuff, they might enjoy reading about stuff.
Wendy touches on Beanie Babies, right?
Yep.
I remember when that was all the rage. Everybody had to have a Beanie Baby. I wonder where those Beanie Babies are now.
Well, they're not worth what they used to be.
Right. And they all said that they came with, oh, that's the other thing about crap that I find interesting. And then we can move on. They come with these certificates of authenticity.
Right.
It's authentic crap. It's not just crap, it's authentic crap.
Yeah, and she talks about that in the book. We didn't touch on that earlier, but something to get the book and read about. The origin of some of these certificates and who was the authority and who signed it. It's all made up. It's all crap.
It's all made up. Well, isn't everything? Moving right along.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations once again on the award, Karen. That is fabulous.
Thank you. It inspires me to go further.
How about that dinner you made yesterday? That was the best. That was the best fool I've ever had. And I put it on a mountain of quinoa and it was fool on the hill.
Maybe that's going to be the name of the recipe because I haven't posted it. I've made it twice now. It started as a concept. And I haven't posted it or written it down.
I think it goes with our conversation because there are lots of dishes that have very interesting names. For example, if you're thinking about crap, there was a dish growing up that was called crap on a shingle.
Oh.
It was
chipped beef.
Beef on toast. Actually, it wasn't. They didn't use the word crap. They used the word.
They used shit on a shingle.
Shit on a shingle.
We can say that. We're progressive.
Yeah. We are. They used shit, but you could say the dish that you made yesterday.
You could say crap on a cracker.
Crap on a cracker or fool on a hill.
Fool on a hill or fool on the hill of quinoa or millet or whatever.
Yeah, it was delicious, though. Tell us about this
okay,
dish.
I know you've talked
about it before. It's not spelled F-O-O-L. It's spelled F-U-L, correct?
Well, it's written in Arabic or Hebrew, so however we want to write it in English, I think, is acceptable. But I typically see it as, yeah, F-U-L.
F-U-L.
Anyway.
So for those of you who are listening and for those of you who care, what is fool?
So the base of fool is fava bean.
Fava bean.
The fava bean, fava beans. And the fava bean, it's a little different from other beans I've found. To start with, the skin of it is really a hard shell. Not quite
yes.
a shell, but when you cook a pinto bean or a black bean, there's a thin little skin on it that you don't even notice.
No.
You cook them, they get cooked, you might see it floating around, but it just kind of blends in
but
with
this
everything
is quite,
else.
This is quite a lot of work that you have to put into a shelling
these
beans.
Yeah, so the fava bean, I buy them dry, and then we soak them like we soak other beans, and soak them well. And then I remove the skins. I suppose you could cook them with the skins. I've tried that. I don't like it very much.
No.
But I removed the skins. And when I was removing the skins, I was practicing conjugating Spanish verbs.
You removed the skins and practiced Spanish verbs.
Yeah.
That's
I just
incredible.
Needed...
I just had to repeat that.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to learn some Spanish.
That's awesome.
Yo
so you kind of went into
Espanol.
A... We talked about a zone last time, but you kind of went into a zone.
I did.
A Spanish
yes.
zone.
Then you cook the beans. And when they're cooked well, they get really soft. They fall apart. And the dish of fool is these cooked fava beans with lemon juice, loads of garlic, loads of parsley, and swimming in olive oil and salt. Now, everybody knows I don't like to use salt or olive oil. I cook the fava beans. After I skin them, I cook them. And then in a saucepan, big saute pan, I cooked onions and lots of celery, almost a whole head of chopped celery. And I realized celery has a salty flavor because it's filled with minerals. Celery is a really healthy food. So I thought it would give the bean dish a suggestion of salt since I don't use salt. And then I added a ton of parsley. Now, the last time I made it, I used dried parsley. And this time we used fresh parsley because we had it.
Yes, it was delicious.
And a lot of garlic.
Yes.
And I waited for all that stuff to get soft, sauteed. And then I mixed in the cooked fava beans and added a lot of fresh lime juice yesterday and... The first time I made it was with lemon juice, because I think it's traditionally with lemon juice. So the traditional fool has olive oil and salt, which I don't use. I use celery instead, and, well, no fat. But I was thinking you could make a tahini dressing, which is sesame tahini and your choice of vinegar or citrus and water. And you could swirl that on top of the fool if you like.
Yes. One time we went to, early in our relationship together, I had never had it. Again, I hadn't had a lot of things until becoming a vegan that I now have as often as possible. One of them being hummus and tahini and falafel and lovely pita bread. Well, you brought me to a Middle Eastern restaurant here in New York and we had a plate of fool. No, wait.
It was in Chicago.
It was in Chicago.
Or it was in Evanston outside of Chicago.
Right.
During one of my chemo
when your
adventures.
Chemo adventures. And they obviously soaked it in olive oil and gave us a big basket of hot pita bread. It is the greatest thing in the world.
I was surprised. That restaurant in Evanston was one of the best Middle Eastern restaurants I have eaten around the country and even in the Middle East.
Yeah, and then we went to seek places like that out wherever we were. I remember waiting for a flight in San Francisco. We had a lot of time, and so we drove to Millbrae, downtown Millbrae, and we, because they had a Middle Eastern restaurant that sold fool, and we had it before our flight. Back to
The foolish memories.
Yes.
The foolish memories. Well, that's fool. And I hope to post the recipe sometime soon. Well, Gary, thanks for joining me. And
thank you, Karen, and congratulations again on the award.
Thank you. Thank you, Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Gary Noll.
Everybody, have a delicious week. Thank you.